A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support.
Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these arts organizations. Today, we'll focus on efforts to recognize and foster diversity in the early music world. Early Music America and the Handel and Haydn Society are presenting a panel discussion featuring leading Black musicians in early music to discuss their experiences and thoughts on how the field can become more diverse and recognize the diversity that already exists. I'll speak with Patricia Ann Neely, a viol player and chair of Early Music America's Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access Task Force, and countertenor Reginald Mobley, programming consultant for the Handel and Haydn Society. Let's start off with a look at some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Despite hopes to welcome limited audiences back as early as summer, Carnegie Hall has announced it will remain dark for the rest of its season amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The famed Manhattan venue formally announced the cancellation of the rest of its planned season this past week, the first time in its history that it will be closed for an entire season. In a statement, Carnegie Hall executive and artistic director Clive Gillinson said that more time was needed to ensure a safe opening. Carnegie Hall will bring its Voices of Hope Festival in April online, examining the resilience of artists throughout history and the works they create during times of crisis and oppression. And in another historic first, the Boston Symphony Orchestra has named a woman as president and chief executive, tapping Los Angeles Philharmonic's chief operating officer Gail Samuel. In this position, Samuel, who is also currently the president of the Hollywood Bowl, will head up the Symphony, the Boston Pops, and Tanglewood. In its statement, the Symphony said Samuel will help oversee the development of new initiatives designed to expand the orchestra's reach into new audiences and digital directions. Samuel, who first joined the LA Philharmonic as orchestra manager in 1993, begins her tenure in Boston June 21st, succeeding Mark Volpe. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. The classical music world has been stepping up its efforts in recent years to become more inclusive and accessible, recognizing and reaching out to musicians and audiences of color. Those in early music have also begun to examine ways to recognize the diverse voices involved in the field now, as well as those who have been makers and consumers of Renaissance, medieval, Baroque, and early classical music. This Sunday, February 21st, Early Music America and the Handel and Haydn Society are presenting an online panel discussion, bringing together six musicians in the field of early music and historical performance practice. The panel will include viol player Patricia Ann Neely, who you just heard performing, and who is chair of Early Music America's Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access Task Force and managing director of Abendmusik, and countertenor Reginald Mobley, who last year was named as the first programming consultant for the Handel and Haydn Society. I chatted with them by Zoom this past week about the goals of the program and some of the issues that might be discussed.
The idea of doing a panel of musicians talking about, you know, the Black experience in Black History Month has been done a lot, but doing it simply on the focus of early music, I don't think has been done. And it hasn't been recently, and it's something that I think is long overdue, especially in the past year, how H&H and EMA and a ton of other early music ensembles, in addition with other ensembles, have been really working hard to kind of tackle the idea of diversity within this specific genre, within the classical genre, subgenre, that has been kind of left as the last faded community and bastion of whiteness in the classical sphere as a whole. So the idea of doing this, I thought, was great. Obviously, I was asked to help put the panel together. And of course, my first thought was, of course, Pat is going to be there. And then Jonathan Woody, who is a great friend and also another prominent voice for people of color in the early music community, had to be there as well. But I thought that instead of just finding a few other people of color or Black people in the early music community in America, half of my career is basically abroad. And I know for a fact that the issues we deal with here are just as prominent in the UK and the rest of Europe. And I thought that we needed to include a couple of early musicians of color abroad to be a part of this, because we needed to make it clear that, yes, this is a problem that we are dealing with specifically, but that it's not just an American issue, and that we needed this to be pretty broad in the sense of showing that the idea of tackling diversity in early music is it's global.
What are some of the specific issues and topics you expect the panel discussion to include and look at?
I believe that the discussion really will explore the journey that each of us has taken in our quest to establish ourselves as professionals in this field. We're represented by a wide spectrum of experiences, singers and instrumentalists, seasoned and younger performers, and European and US-based, as Reggie mentioned. I think it's important to get a global picture of just where each of us are in our, you know, right now, and how we persevered to get here, and the challenges and the accolades that we, you know, can bring up to encourage people, but also make them aware of what the struggle still is in this particular field.
I think some of the issue that'll be brought up is just simply, how do we solve the idea of access? How do we solve the problem with access? The fact that as people of color, people like Pat and myself and Jonathan, like, this wasn't a foregone conclusion that we would be early musicians, much less classical musicians. I would love to see how far we've come. You know, Pat has been in the game when early music was fighting for its own, you know, validity, but to fight for the validity of early music and as a person of color and as a female of color, I mean, it's just, there's so much that we should know how things started from the beginning, and we should know if we've made that much progress now. As long as I've been in the game, which hasn't been, you know, that long, maybe 10 years at this point, I've only noticed even an interest in tackling this issue in the past maybe 2 years. So I can't imagine that we've made too much progress, but then if we're all of a sudden trying to scramble to realize that we should tackle this. And, you know, the fact that a lot of this was instigated by the police brutality and horrific murders in the past year during a pandemic, you know, I'm saddened that it took that to get us to wake up, but it would be good to know and just kind of figure out those issues like access. And also, not just on stage, but how do we get people that look like us in seats as well? Like, it's just, I think, a comprehensive idea of where we were, where we are now, and where we should be in the next few years is important as for the panel to kind of discuss and talk about. But also, you know, just getting, it shouldn't all just be fire and brimstone and German Lutheran preaching, you know, at the audience. I think it's important for us to also talk about how we got to where we are, to see if maybe if there is a spark or some catalyst that we can kind of latch on to and quantify that does lead people that look like us early music. It's a matter of trying to catch that lightning, you know, and bottle it.
Well, now each of your organizations have taken on some initiatives at EMA. It's the IDEA initiative, and Reggie just came on to, you were brought in part at H&H to look at that in part through the Every Voices. What are some of the ways that you have seen, if not actual movement forward, better recognition and better understanding, and even just the beginning of the process of understanding?
I think you answered your question before you asked it. The fact that there is this task force now with EMA, the fact that the Every Voice Project has grown as much as it has, and that they created this position of programming consultant and actually have a diversity and inclusion team with H&H, I think the fact that they're not just saying it's a problem that needs to be solved, but we're putting the tools and kind of parts in place to work towards, at the very least, collecting the data and finding out, you know, where there's a breakdown in access and in finding out where people you know, where musicians, especially musicians of color, feel like they're included or welcome into early music. So I think the fact that these exist now is a really good start. I won't let anyone rest on their laurels yet. I don't think it's enough to like pat ourselves in the back, but it's a start that is long overdue, but I'm glad it has happened finally.
Yeah, and I think, I think in the early 2000s, there was an article that I actually asked EMA Magazine to consider, and they did, on people of color in the field at that point. And Heidi Whaleson wrote that article and interviewed a wide variety of people. And then I asked EMA to do this again 10 years later. And at that point, a different writer wrote the article. And it was, you know, to test the climate, to see if anything had changed then. There had been no initiatives, but there were more people becoming professionals. I mean, when I started, I was the only African-American professional in early music in this country. I can easily say that. And by the time of this second article, it was common practice to be hired for a concert and to see more people of color in the orchestra and in the chorus, if that was part of the programming. But what hasn't been addressed is, what is it like to be that person now? As someone who was the only person performing, diversity never came up. The issues of diversity didn't come up, because if I was hired, I was hired because they wanted me for my talent. But what has happened now is that I experienced a whole different environment in rehearsal and in scholarship than I did early on when I was pursuing this in college. When you're performing, people are listening to you for what you do. When you're rehearsing, they're listening to your opinion, they're listening to what kind of scholarship you bring, and what kind of value you bring to the discussion. And that's where I find that we have not made progress. When I worked with Sequentia in Germany, that was not the case at all. And I felt that I was with a group, anyone who was in Europe at that time chose to be there because of the value of working in an environment that was subsidized and invited an international group of musicians to perform. So I was just considered another American performer who was there with other Americans and other nationalities. I felt more valued in Europe than I did in my own home country. And once I returned to the United States, all of a sudden I brought some value because I had performed with a specific group. And it wasn't until then that I felt that I was being taken seriously. Before I left, I couldn't get a permanent seat in any organization that was an early music organization. They always came up with an excuse. You never studied at a conservatory in Europe. You have a full-time job, so are you really committed to this? But, you know, I persevered because I knew this is what I wanted, and I had the support of professors in college who were very well known in their field in early music, and a teacher who started me off in high school, who was an African-American jazz composer whose influence was Machaut. So I knew that I had the expertise, I had the academic drive, but I did not expect to be challenged for my assets as I had in the beginning here in this country.
To a lesser extent, I have a similar story to Pat, in that I really was only taken serious. I was really treated more like an equal without exception when I was in Europe. Whenever I work in Europe, I'm the American. The only thing that really sets me apart is that I'm forced on tour to explain how caucuses work and how the Electoral College works. That's the only thing people care about. And it's only, you know, in the past 4 or 5 years when the issue of police brutality and senseless murder of Black bodies really became an issue, that all of a sudden everyone in Europe saw me as a Black person, as just an American. And that was very interesting to me, because I know for a fact that there are issues there, but they just keep them pretty tamped down because they can always point at the bigger fire across the pond. At least we're not them. But seeing how things are here and knowing me, there has been this kind of awakening with groups I've worked with, where they're starting to actually pay attention to not just the issue itself, but how it transfers to issues in Germany and issues in France and issues with race in the UK specifically, which is why Joe and Rachel were invited to be a part of this. And in coming back, it's kind of given me a little more confidence to not walk in a room and feel completely self-conscious that I'm the only Black person in the room, which definitely was the case before. I mean, for everyone that'll be in this panel, we all have the experience of walking onto a stage, walking into a hall, walking into a room, and knowing that we are the only one there, and that either we're not seen because of who we are, and people are hyper aware because of who we are. So it's just an issue that that I'm always kind of cognizant of, but I'm always kind of aware of and trying to kind of explain. And I think the more we kind of multiply the voices, a chorus of people who are saying, this is the issue, that finally maybe people will start to listen. Because I know that even with all the progress you've made in the past year or two with EMA and H&H and all these other ensembles, there are still quite a few people that aren't listening. And it's evident if you read Twitter comments, our comments on Facebook, or on YouTube with concerts, that it's still an issue with listeners, audience members, as well as musicians and people, as far up as the highest parts of administration. So you become hyper aware, you become kind of an expert in the field of diversity when it's your lived experience. And within early music, we've gained that extra degree in life that's helped us to kind of unpack it for ourselves, for our own healing and for our own ability to process. But it also, because we know how to take it apart and put it all back together again, we know how to speak eloquently on the matter. We know how to kind of help explain to people that don't understand or haven't become aware of it, that this is the problem, that this needs to be changed, that enough is enough.
You've referred a few times also to the audience aspect of that as well. And certainly as you did point out, even among general audiences, early music is kind of seen as the pedestal on the pedestal. As lovers of early music, what are some of the ways that you've found or you'd like to explore to really expand that audience and make it a more welcoming atmosphere?
It's a multidisciplinary approach. We have to show people that they can be on stage and look like us, but where do we also find, get them to find that interest? It's looking back at history. It's looking at visual art, where there are paintings that show Africans or other ethnicities in the same context as white royals. We have information now on the Black communities that were prevalent during the time of Henry VIII in England. They were all free once they landed on shore. We know that Henry VIII's principal trumpet player was Black, John Blank, and we know the history of their relationship, how much he valued John Blank, and so that he contributed financially to his wedding, and John Blank was able to live a comfortable middle-class life in 16th century England. We know about the composers now who are represented as African composers of classical music, Le Chevalier de Saint-Georges, Bridge Tower. We are looking back more in time to show where we were as a people and how that translates into something that's positive. You see paintings of maybe a black child holding up a piece of music so that a white lute player can play. And I always say this, it's not that this was a servant doing this. This is a young child who obviously had to know the music in order to turn the pages and obviously was listening to this in a different way, in a more important way than someone would if they were sitting in the background raking leaves or something. So all of this does count in terms of building the knowledge. There's also my interest in Alessandro de' Medici, who is considered to be the black Medici in the family, first Duke of Florence. He was a patron of the arts. And who were those composers under his employ? One was Jacques Arcadelt, a composer that we all know from the Renaissance period. And there were trumpet players, two black trumpet players in Germany that Arne Spohr has been doing a lot of research on, who also were taken under the wing of people of influence and provided the means with which to live a comfortable life. That's a different concept of how we envision the black experience throughout history. We always consider ourselves marginalized and subject to being servants. But race in that particular time was a different concept than it was during our history in America of slavery in the 17th century.
I think there is a pathway forward if we kind of understand that early music, like basically there's this kind of stereotype or preconceived notion about what early musicians are. The so-called, hobbyist recorder players in Birkenstocks who live in all white neighborhoods far outside of city centers, who are completely unrelated to other people, and that couldn't be further from the truth. I think it's important to kind of reclaim what early music is and what it could be and what it was. I spent a lot of time kind of shouting from the rooftops about the similarities between Baroque music and jazz, and the fact that jazz is actually kind of the spiritual successor to what Baroque music and early music might have been. In that sense, early music as a movement now, knowing that it is not and cannot be what it was in the 17th and 18th century, is actually a new genre altogether. It's more of a movement than, a revolution than a movement. I mean, it's rejecting what was, but we're taking a lot of cues from what jazz was in its conception. Like, we're actually, I think of the early music community as the younger brother of jazz. In that we have that same kind of free spirit and willingness to kind of dispense with a lot of formality. Of course, there is a lot of, there are tons of rules and tons of formalities and tons of things, criticism, and all those things. But when you actually get into the weeds of what early music is, it's about affect, it's about emotion, it's about people. Like, it doesn't live until you add that spark of the human element. The spots on the page is just, it's just the chart. It isn't all-encompassing, it isn't music what it is. And so I think, in a way, what we kind of offer with early music relates more to people because we require who you are as a person, as a musician, to be a part of this, to make this what we do alive. And we have to be able to relate to each other in that way. And I think that speaks more to people that look like me and Pat than some of the very button laced up formal ways that kind of those Victorian kind of long hair, tails, pine tails, sort of very strict classical norms that you stereotype with Stokowski and Bugs Bunny cartoons. It's not that. It's so much more relatable to who we are. I think of what, this music that we kind of live in relates to the person. I think, music of the 18th, the 30 Years' War, how a lot of the music that came out of that was a reflection and processing of the sorrow and grief and pain of this senseless, massive war that took place, in Central Europe. And at the very same time as that was going on, there was a new type of music coming up in the New World from people who were taken from their home and forced to toil fields and pick cotton and build the country that we live in now. We are related, absolutely related. And it's important to understand that we are all a part of each other. And I just happen to personally feel that early music is, at least in where we come from, or where we live in the classical genre, that's the most relevant to who we are now. That's the most brilliant way we can find ways to process everything that we deal with today. There are so many pieces, works of, you know, from Ockeghem to Bach, that in just a few notes and words encompass the past 4 years of political trauma in America. It's absolutely incredible, and it's all there, and it's waiting for us. We just have to dispense with all of our preconceived notions. We have to dispense with all that's kind of, you know, kept us apart and kept us feeling as though we're better than the other, and just realize that we are connected through this. This is who we are and who we should be. And so I think if we can get to the point where we can see the lack of people of color in what we do as a problem, then perhaps once we kind of figure that problem out and solve that problem, that we can move forward to figuring out how to just use what we do, use what we are, to really kind of grow and make things a little better. Like, music is not just entertainment, music is service. And I think early music for me stands at the top of that.
If we go back even further to the Middle Ages, where there wasn't a barrier between the East and West, you have this coalition of Eastern and Western music that was built on the Crusades. I mean, it's just like jazz. There were rules and regulations also in theory on how to put together monophonic music, what progressions were acceptable and what weren't, more just like in jazz. And the people who played that music are depicted in visual art. Again, if you think of the cantigas, there are miniatures of an Eastern player playing with a Western player, one on an oud and one on a lute. So, you know, when we talked ages ago about crossover music, I had to remind someone last year that it's no longer crossover, it's just early music.
This is just the experience and, you know, viewpoints and thoughts from just two of us on this panel. I think we'll find even more when you hear what Jonathan and Joe and Rachel and even Dana, what they have to say. And I think even the two of us will find something new and grow a bit from this panel.
That was my conversation with countertenor Reginald Mobley, who last year was named as the first programming consultant for the Handel and Haydn Society, and viol player Patricia Ann Neely, managing director of Abendmusik and chair of Early Music America's Task Force on Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access. The panel discussion will be streamed live Sunday, February 21st at 2 p.m. on EMA's Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter accounts, as well as at earlymusicamerica.org. I hope you enjoy the conversations I bring you each week on A Tempo, focusing on the changes and challenges facing the performing arts. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.